This is Audible.
Christian Audio presents Sex, Jesus, and the Conversations the Church Forgot, written and read by Mo Isom. You can find additional writings, videos, and more at moisom.com. To my humble husband, Jeremiah, thank you for choosing me. God's immeasurable grace comes to life in the most overwhelming ways through your love. You stared at my past and took a knee for my future. I'm so honored to be your bride. You will always be my one and only. With love, your only one. Introduction. Sex. I don't think we're talking about it enough. Sure, our culture is saturated with it. Our computer screens are pumped full of it. Our televisions ooze it. Our radios scream about it. Magazines and books and apps and social media outlets stream it down our throats. Lust, body ideals, pleasure, foreplay, porn, adultery. We're obsessed with it. We're fixated on it. We're entertained by it. We think we're deeply all informed about it. We boast in the freedom we have to do what we want with our bodies. We tally the number of partners we've had. We're convinced it's necessary in a normal dating relationship. We're numb to the random hookups and one-night stands. We want to experience it, tease it, taste it, flaunt it, worship it. But we're not willing to really sit down and talk about it. While society twists, perverts, cheapens, and idolizes it, we, the church, are relatively silent about it, awkwardly stumbling around it, running from it, building desperate rule lists of do's and don'ts, and as a result, allowing the sanctity of God to be stolen by the insatiable lust of the lost. Somewhere along the way, we've allowed ourselves to be drowned out of the conversation. In a half-hearted attempt to stay relevant and relatable, we've caved into the narrative that sex, the most prominent and overwhelming focus of our entire society, isn't for us to really talk about, right? Wrong. It's our responsibility to talk about it. It's our calling as a body of believers to share the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and every version of the Holy Scriptures I've ever read talks openly and candidly about sex. It's a topic fiercely close to God's heart, a topic that flows from the pages of His Word, a topic laced with affirmation, guidance, and reproof. God, after all, is the inventor of sex. We're made by Him as sexual beings. So if it's a topic fiercely close to His heart, it must become a topic fiercely close to ours. I choose to speak up, not as a preacher, but as a pilgrim who learned every hard lesson every hard way, who sinned time and time and time again in search of a pleasure I just couldn't find, who has a mess of a testimony that was nurtured and redeemed by a King who makes our hopeless things holy. I'll speak up for every person whose family thought their church was having certain conversations with them, the ones whose church thought their family was having certain conversations with them, the same ones who were then force-fed more than they needed to see and know by a shameless culture that couldn't have cared less about them. I'll speak up for the teen who is tangled in the bondage of pornography, for the girlfriend feeling pressured to go further and give it up in order to show her boyfriend how much she loves him. For the college-aged co-ed who can't escape the constant temptation and stimulation on every app, website, and show. For the woman who saved herself before marriage and couldn't figure out why she felt so ashamed on her wedding night. For the wife and husband who at times feel like disconnected strangers between their own sheets. For the person who can so casually watch sex play out on TV and movie screens and still can't figure out why they're dissatisfied with the real thing. And for every person in between, I'll speak up. I'll speak up with a voice that's unashamed to stand up to a crazed and confused world and redefine sex by its God-designed meaning. A voice that's not afraid to bear my battle wounds if they help point anyone back to God's redeeming truth. A voice that's sick and tired of the world pressuring us to ride its ever-changing tide. One that's found its firm foundation in God's unchanging truth. Reclaiming sex as the act of holy worship God always intended it to be isn't taboo or embarrassing. It's eternity shifting. And eternity matters to me. It's time to begin reclaiming sex for the glory of God. It's time to invite Jesus back into the bedroom. It's time to start the conversations that the church forgot, and to stand up boldly as a body of believers and defend the most intimate act of worship and praise we're free to know. It's time to equip our minds and hearts with the truth of our value, our self-control, our bodies, and our relationships. It's time to start to understand and lean into the roots of why God cares so deeply about sex, and be reminded that sex begins within the condition of our own hearts. At the end of the day, in a suffocating world, the Word of God breathes boldly true. Whether you listen now, learn it the hard way later, or forever try your hardest to repress the truth, one day you will stand before the Lord and He will search your heart and know your truth. But in the meantime, you have the opportunity to encounter His shame-destroying grace. Have your heart perspective reframed and find freedom in His loving reproof. So this book is for you. I don't have all the answers, and I don't have space in these pages to address all of the different types of sexual sin struggles that are manifesting in our world and possibly have collided with your life too. The things I've personally experienced are all I really have any authority to speak into. I only have my testimony, but I know God uses our vulnerability for His glory, so I trust He will use these words in diverse and wonderful ways, with more intention than I could ever hope to. Please hang with me through this book. I know there is a piece in here for you. If you're the weary wanderer navigating how your sexual identity and your faith become married at the cross, I hope you'll see this book through. If your perspective on sex has been shaped by the world rather than the Word for long enough, I hope my reckless and redeemed testimony will connect with you. If you're finally ready to replace perversion with purpose and pain with purity, then this book, my friend, is written for you. I pray God meets you through these words, collects the pieces of your fractured story, and resurrects in your heart the beautiful reminder that He alone can make all things new. Chapter 1. Let's call it like it is. I couldn't forget the night if I tried. It was just one instance of one too many. I sat on the bed while he was half undressed, and part of me wondered how on earth I even got there. The guy I actually liked was in the other room, with another girl, doing who knows what. But there I sat with his friend, who no part of me even respected, hoping that maybe if I seemed cool and low maintenance and fun, he'd do me the favor of passing on a good word. I rationalized away the conviction spinning through my head and once again gave in to the choice I didn't even want to make. He got what he came for, a small piece of foreplay, a half-hearted performance. I pretended to enjoy it, then lay there wondering how much longer I needed to continue to pretend I was drunk so the shame of this wouldn't feel like quite so much. What was I doing? How did I get here? Every part of me knew that I carried more worth. I was so much more valuable than this dispensable, passed-around girl. But somehow I was back here, in the filth I'd never thought I'd find myself in, pawning off my value in desperate hopes of feeling loved, giving men my body in hopes that they would give me their hearts. Somehow I, the smart, well-mannered, high-achieving, churched girl, was drowning in my choices, a slave to sin I'd never cared to learn enough about, stuck playing the tired games of the world. Band-aids and bullet holes. I'll be the first to admit my sexual testimony is a mess. A mess of misguidance and misbehavior, confusion and conviction, rebellion and repentance. It's a maze of boundary pressing and power leveraging, ignorance and impatience, lust and lost wandering. Add to the mix an overwhelming dose of overexposure, countless control issues, grief-triggered overcompensation, and a catastrophic case of insecurity. And there you have it. Me. A well-rounded girl on the surface, blindly stumbling through a sin-filled battlefield within my heart. The captain, my sin nature. The casualty, my soul. It's easy to see now that almost all of my sexual frustrations, bondage, and brokenness grew out of the fact that ultimately I knew nothing about sex. And I mean nothing. But you couldn't have told me that then. No, I lived most of my adolescence and young adulthood confidently convinced that I knew all there was to know about it. I saw what the world showed me. I listened to what the world told me. I was interested, enticed, and aware of this sex thing that seemed so delightfully imposing. I had a laundry list of thoughts, ideas, reasons, and rationalizations. On the outside, I was a good girl from a good family, smart and well-mannered. But in my own mind, I waved the proud banners of wonder and womanhood, my freedom of exploration, my right to my own body and my own sexual identity, my entitlement to dress and act as I pleased. My moral compass often hinged on what was socially acceptable at the time, which seemed to be a more and more permissive guide as I moved through different seasons of life. In our culture, sexual expression is praised, and women, above all else, hold great power and esteem if their beauty and sexuality are enticing. After all, it's our body, our life, and our choices. That's what we're conditioned to believe and how we're conditioned to behave. But in truth, I knew absolutely nothing about sex. Real sex. That holy kind of sacrificial sex, that God-designed act of worship created to righteously unify a husband and a wife bound by the commitment of a covenant. That act that carries the weight of the cross in its wake and teaches us the power of tangling souls under a promise made before the Creator of it all. That comfort-bringing, fear-dispelling, soul-sanctifying kind of sex. That God-pleasing sex worth waiting for and celebrating, worth saving until His design designates. That all-inclusive physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual surrender. No, I knew nothing about that sex. And the church didn't talk about it either. All the church talked about was not having sex, always boxing sex into the confines of do's and don'ts, rights and wrongs, always under the awkward and tentative guise that that topic wasn't the most comfortable to address. They often spoke with careful, prepackaged words, words that seemed detached from any relatability to what was actually going on in the world outside of those walls. It was as if they were afraid to have those types of conversations too soon or too late. To be too honest or too mundane, as if they were overwhelmed by the tangled layers of all that topic contains and so instead kept the dialogue safe. And, I would imagine, hoped the families were diving deeper and teaching more at home. I can hardly blame them. Not only is the topic of sex a layered, complex, and multifaceted discussion, but on top of the complexity it's already blanketed in, the world has essentially bullied the church out of the conversation. The world has so massively exalted, worshipped, and stolen ownership of all things sex-related that the church has, at times, lost footing and leverage in the fight for young people's attention. So in an effort to get even a whisper of truth into the screaming match that is the great worldly sexual debate, the church has often clung to the simple and clear articulation of what is sin and what is not, the rule list of what to do and what not to do. But the infection that's grown out of that incomplete prescription is that we don't want to avoid something just because we're told to. When a list of right and wrong is all that's reinforced, we begin to see the holy and hope-filled Word of God as a rule book rather than a love letter written to our hearts. A layered and wisdom-soaked love letter gently explaining the deep-rooted whys that compel us to live differently from the start. And sure, consequences are a compelling force for following the rules, but we're a generation of compartmentalized conscience. We compartmentalize our faith from our actions to serve our own desires. We often disregard the rule list and act according to impulse. Then, foolishly and soul-threateningly, we remarry the entities when they collide and get mad at God for the consequences and cause and effect results in our life. And we struggle with our faith, doubting the goodness of a God we never cared to actually understand or obey in the first place. But as a result of this tug-of-war for a seat at the table in people's hearts, there is a massive conversation that the church forgot, a conversation that comes from the lips of a king and begins long before the symptomatic response of promiscuity. We've forgotten to celebrate sex as an incredible gift given to us by God, and instead have solely preached against the symptoms, forgetting to address the root of it all. As the church, we've forgotten to talk about the whys. We've forgotten to start from the beginning and share why and what should frame and guide our sexual understanding. We've stood at the pulpit and shaken our frustrated fists at the world, preaching about the failings of our sexual morality and our lack of self-control. But we've forgotten to first address the aching, bleeding needs of people's hearts. We're trying to put band-aids on bullet holes, from bullets that never should have had the power to penetrate our God-designed souls. We need to know the whys at the root of our wandering. We need to know the cause at the core of our temptation. We need to hear more than do this, don't do that. We need to know why it matters to listen and obey in the first place. Because most of our sexual sin struggles grow out of our lack of a deep-rooted understanding of what sex is, how God sees us, why God calls us to what he does, and why obedience to that calling is worth the sacrifice. Sexual understanding, above all things, is not simply about behavior modification. It's about heart transformation. But at the beginning of heart transformation comes heart education. So before my testimony can carry any leverage or impact, we have to get on the same page about what sex truly is, and we have to open our hearts to the whys that will ultimately be the only things that can compel response. At the root of it all, it helps to start this whole sexual conversation with an accurate and perspective-shifting definition, or for many, redefinition, of what sex even is. Sex is God's invention. It's comprised of physical, mental, emotional, and above all, spiritual acts of connection designed by the Creator for the unity, pleasure, and reproduction of the very lives he created. Sex is a holy gift, purely designed by a God who delights in lavishing his creations with every good and perfect blessing. It is a pure act given to us as a gift to enjoy and delight in under the divine guidance of the appropriate context, circumstances, and boundaries. Sex is an all-consuming, all-inclusive act of worship and praise. It can't stand alone as just a physical act, or just an emotional act, or just a mentally engaged decision. We can rationalize all day long that sex can be had in a detached manner, but in reality we're only fooling ourselves. That argument is invalid and baseless, really, because sexual acts always tie souls. They always leave a mark. They were always intended to. Whether we carry them out within God's design is what determines whether that mark is a seal or a scar, because sexual acts were designed to bind two people. In the God-designed context between a husband and a wife, sex is one of the most powerful agents of unification, devotion, and surrender. But outside the guidelines God designed for his own invention, sexual acts become sin, and sin only ever serves to unhinge. Physically, sex includes a beautiful range of acts and expressions. Mentally, sex is a catalyst for the activation of unbelievably powerful neurotransmitters in our minds. Emotionally, sex is an expression of love, surrender, trust, and sacrificial service to another. And spiritually, sex is a tangler of souls, a bonding agent that leaves a permanent imprint on our hearts and our spirits. Sex is powerful and purposeful in as simple as it is deeply complex. It's the most incredible and freeing gift in the appropriate context. But when we simplify or cheapen or commercialize sex as anything less than what it truly is and what purpose it serves in God's absolute and perfect design, we open a Pandora's box of ways that our minds, our hearts, our bodies, and our souls can be trivialized. My research for this book was absolutely dizzying. The statistics I found reflecting young people's exposure to, perceptions of, and practices of many things that fall under the sexual umbrella were as varying and confused and extreme and daunting as you could imagine. What they summarized for me was a clear and undisputable fact that we as a culture have very mixed perspectives, opinions, and definitions of sex, as well as what qualifies as sexual sin. And the sources of those definitions are about as unreliable, misinterpreted, and widely varying as the numbers they reflect. But before we get all high and mighty as Bible-believing Christians and think that somehow our demographic is exempt from the nauseating stats and figures, prepare for a reality check. because professed Christians are the very ones who comprise some of the most startling stats. And it all serves as evidence that even the church is missing the mark in teaching biblical literacy about sex as a whole. Did you know that 96% of young adults, professed evangelical Christians included, are either encouraging, accepting, or neutral in their view towards pornography, and don't see the use of porn as a sin? As a result, in 2016 alone, people watched 4.6 billion hours of pornography at just one website, the biggest porn site in the world. That's 524,000 years of porn, or, if you will, around 17,000 complete lifetimes in one year. Another study conducted in 2016 found that 82% of teens desired to have only one partner for life, but also found that only 3% of Americans actually wait to have sex until marriage. Just 3%. And sadly, as you'll learn through the pages of my story, just because someone waited to have intercourse until their wedding day in no way guarantees they never struggled with other types of sexual sin. For women utilizing online dating platforms, 33% admit to having had sex on their very first online dating encounter. And one-third of the young adult population between the ages of 20 and 26 admit to having posted nude or semi-nude content online. From 2012 to 2016, 41.2% of women conceived pregnancies out of wedlock. And in 2014 alone, there were 1,609,619 out-of-wedlock births. There are so many more facts and figures and numbers and polls that serve to showcase the current sexual climate of our society. But what these types of stats scream to me are two primary things. First, you are not alone in your sexual wandering. 97% of us, and I think it's safe to say a decent chunk of that remaining 3%, know the power of sexual temptation, lust, desire, and action outside of God's design. So if it's any solace right from the start, you're not the outlier. You haven't gone farther or done more or seen the worst repercussions compared to anyone else. And I'm in your boat. I know I've had my share of struggles too. I hope I can weave my words together well enough throughout this book that you close the cover knowing you are understood and loved. Redemption finds us where we are, and it's waiting here for you. It sits among the 97% and offers hope. Second, I'm reminded in looking at these numbers that these stats and figures and polls are just symptoms. They're evidence that in the midst of a sex-saturated world, we do not know as much about sex as we think. Because if we deeply understood the physical, mental, emotional, and above all spiritual definition of and implications of sex, I don't think these numbers would look anywhere near the same. I don't think they could. Education can't help but lead to revelation, and revelation can't help but lead to transformation when we accept God's definition as truth. Understanding God's design of sex and the fact that it is far, far more than a physical expression can't help but compel us to understanding there is weight in the act. There are lifelong and even eternal implications at stake. There are either life-draining or life-training practices at work in the process, depending on how we handle ourselves sexually. There is heavy significance in the heart condition we carry as we move through our days. We are sexual beings because sex is a deep and instructed desire in our hearts. God placed it there. But if we do not know the holy premise behind the pleasure, we become ill-equipped to handle temptation, ill-armored to fight sexual fixation, and ill-willed toward a God who we think demands obedience for the empty sake of obeying moral law. Understanding and appreciating the true definition of sex and God's design must be followed by understanding and appreciating the whys that compel us to care. Because the what and the whys strengthen one another. The what equips our minds, but the whys compel our hearts. Our sexual perspectives will never be compelled to change until the whys catapult our heart condition to change first. God's will for you is to be holy, so stay away from all sexual sin. Then each of you will control his own body and live in holiness and honor, not in lustful passion like the pagans who do not know God and his ways. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 3 through 5. Chapter 2, The Whys, Where We Must Begin. I didn't begin with the intent to sin. I rounded one too many bases with one too many baseball players during my early years in college. I lacked any and all discretion. I desperately chased my need for shallow affirmation. And ultimately, I made myself available to anyone who wanted a piece of me. The baseball team seemed to be my niche, and before I knew it, I had built a reputation that preceded me. It's humiliating to look back and realize I was the girl being passed around. I thought for sure at the time that I was in the driver's seat. I wanted so deeply for one of them to choose me, to really choose me. I didn't enjoy the casual nature of it all. I deeply wanted a relationship and genuine connectivity. But all I knew was how to use my sexuality as a tool, my first line of seduction in hopes I could eventually snag one of their hearts, too. I was a wounded woman. I had struggled with my identity for years, recently and unexpectedly lost my father to suicide, and was in a season of running as far and as fast as I could from God. That's not to wrap any excuses around my behavior, but rather to illustrate just a few of the countless factors that layered themselves underneath the shell of a girl who was always a good time at the bar. Desperate girls do desperate things when they don't feel loved. And no matter how hard I tried to craft my image on the surface, sexual sin was the enticement I always let in. Those early years in college were the darkest and most shame-filled years of my life sexually. They were the height of my sexual deviance, my dark internal struggles, and my imprisonment to sin. But do you notice how that climax has only given rights to sit at the start of my story? The shame and embarrassment and reputation and repercussions of those dark nights under different sheets don't get any authority over me or the pages of my story. Because their peak in my life ultimately looks like a ripple in a pond compared to the colossal tsunami of Christ's glory that pulled me out of my brokenness. I've spent a lot of time thinking back to why I made so many of the choices I did throughout my life. Plenty of poor and misguided decisions that you'll hear about through this book. But the more I've thought back on my sexual journey, the more I realize that beneath layers and layers of symptomatic, sinful behavior rested the fundamental truths I completely missed, or others missed in teaching me as I grew. In truth, my sexual struggles began long before any type of sexual activity. My promiscuity and deep soul wounds grew out of a heart that was out of tune. My tossed around, inhibitions down, performance-based cry for love never began with a conscious decision that sexual acts were something I wanted or needed regardless of truth. No, I began by missing the simplest, most basic fundamentals about the very person staring back at me in the mirror. And I wonder if that's where your sexual sin began too. God's first command and our inherent worth. God's word is full of stories, lessons, teachings, parallels, and anecdotes about sex. It's kind of amazing. I don't think I ever realized how much sexual content was in the Bible until I began to marry my faith and sexuality in my heart and seek out what God actually had to say about it all. That wasn't until the end of my time in college, and I wish constantly I had paid attention sooner. Because tuning in to what God has to say about all that falls under the umbrella of sex is like discovering the blueprint for a layer of ourselves and our human nature we didn't even know existed. It is a revelatory piece of the why that can compel us to live differently, and it sat on my bookshelf and bedside table collecting dust while I wandered aimlessly through misguided sexual struggles and lust. In fact, the beginning of a deeper understanding of the beauty and significance of sex is found in the first few pages of Scripture. Some of God's very first words over humankind were about our inherent value as His creations and about this act He created called sex. God Himself wasted no time. I think that's why I find it funny when I hear that some think as Christians we're too pure to talk about these types of things. Conversations about sex mirror the first holy conversation God ever held with humans. To talk about sex openly as a body of believers is to look more and more like the King who created it. Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 through 28 simply says, "So God created human beings in His own image. In the image of God He created them. Male and female He created them. Then God blessed them and said, 'Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and govern it. Reign over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, and all the animals that scurry along the ground.'" When I read this scripture, my heart dives in so much deeper than the few words on the page. I see the beginnings of a love letter written to our hearts about who we are, whose we are, and what God has for us. So God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, the one who placed the stars in the sky and formed each and every beautiful complex creature, the one who set the waves in the sea and rolled the land with hills and valleys, the one who painted day in the sky and appropriated night, the one who formed this massive, sprawling, incomprehensible world and every tiny detail within it, formed you. Above all other creatures, He created you as the pinnacle of His work. No other creature was formed in His image. No other creature given authority to rule over and care for the rest of His construction. But you, us, both man and woman, made equally in His form, with neither man nor woman being made more in the image of God than the other, but both being made in His perfect and unique design. And when He looked at what He made, He was so well pleased. When He looks at you, He stands in awe of His work. He blessed us, and in as gentle a tone as a father and as powerful a tone as the unparalleled creator, He first spoke, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth." Be fruitful and multiply. Be productive, constructive, and useful. Be beneficial, be gainful, be effective. Don't get distracted. Be all that I formed you to be in my image. Trust my design. Know that I know far more detail about your heart and your body than you can even conceive. And as you live a life in worship and wonder of my beautiful work, multiply. Delight in this pleasure I pour out to you. Come together as I have designed you. Follow the instruction that I will give you. And in an abiding, blessed, and covenantal love, multiply for the glory of God. This is not to put words in God's mouth, but to put context in your heart. You, your body, and your life were created with purpose. If we're creatures made in His image above all other creatures on earth, then our bodies are sacred in His sight. And if God wasted no time in addressing sex, then there must be holy context to the act. A holy context that marries our inherent value with our God-instructed sexual rights. Our immeasurable worth as image-bearing creations of God and our sexual identity have been unified since the beginning of creation. And if we learn about one but not the other, or value one above the other, we unwind two truths about our very nature that were never meant to know divide. When we compartmentalize and unhinge the two, we rob ourselves of the unifying identity assigned to both from the beginning. And as a result, we stumble into sexual sin struggles because we're searching for the very thing we dislocated from our sexual obedience at the start, our value. We use sexual power and prowess and pleasure to search for affirmation and love because we've unknowingly cut ourselves off from the true affirmation and love we've already received from the start. We fail to see our own worth, so we search for someone to assign it to us. We seek attention and praise, missing all that God has already said about us, longing to know and feel that we're worth something because we never knew we were originally worth everything through God's incredible design. The why simply begins there, with you and me. Why does it matter what we do with our bodies and who we connect our lives to sexually? Because you and I were created by a King. A King with specific guidance and direction for us. A King who is incapable of creating worthless things. We were created in the image of God, in that perfect image created with everything of God, everything wonderful and spiritual and eternal stamped into our DNA. We are not just here. We are His, and that changes everything. Psalm 139, verses 13 through 14 sings, "For you created my innermost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well." If you are one of His works, what does that say about you? We were created with immeasurable worth, value, beauty, and purpose. We were fearfully and wonderfully made. We were placed on this earth for such a time as this, and we are worth more than I think we realize. We don't need a partner to assign us a value when we feel worthless. We need a soul reawakened to its worth in the Father's eyes. Our value is found in the very image in which we're made. We are God's greatest design, and it's due time we started clinging to this truth and disciplining this belief into our minds. Our actions are significant and carry more purpose than we recognize. And there is more significance to our sexual expression than we realize. All that falls under the umbrella of sex has meaning and purpose in God's design. The way you carry yourself and who you give yourself to is ultimately a reflection of the value you assign to His creation in you. We are worth more than the world's confused games, more than the world's trial and error sexual maze. We must believe that if God's very first instruction to humanity involved identity, sex, and a commissioning of purpose, then there is far more to sex than the guessing game the world invites us to publicly play. The world invites us to put our bodies, our emotions, and our naivety on display as we navigate the web it has woven to satisfy the insatiable lust of the lost. But the Word invites us to so much more. If we aren't aware of our deep-seated value and worth in God's eyes at our creation, then the temptation to define our own identity will always rob us of the purity called from us first. Choosing to choose for ourselves. Another layer of understanding the why is understanding the role we play in why sexual misunderstanding, temptation, and deviance run so rampant in our hearts. If sex was a gift given to us by God, pure in its intent and edifying of our worth, then why is it also the source of so much dissension, obsession, abuse, and hurt? When did sex go from virtue to vice? The answer lies within the very same creation God so fearfully and wonderfully designed. We were creatures made to worship. God Himself created us with the desire to worship coursing through our hearts. It's a predisposition inherent and ingrained and eternal, and there was and is nothing flawed in God's design. Our struggles, then, don't originate from our ingrained desire to worship. They originate from what we choose to worship in our lives. Because it's no mystery that we are all worshiping something, someone, some dream. We were made to exalt, but somewhere along the line, we became willing to exalt anything. It's important we first understand where our broken exaltation began, because humankind never intended to be bad. We as a culture, and often as a church, have somehow bought into the hard and fast belief that sin is as simple as bad versus good, wrong versus right, hate versus love, when in actuality, sin is far more complex than that. Sin never entered into the world because people intentionally chose to be bad. As God's perfect and crafted creations, given the freedom of choice from a loving Creator, we didn't revolt with the desire to be bad people. We revolted with the desire to be our own people. And all that could come from that was the bad and the broken we wrestle with now. We revolted as His people to become our own people. And through the course of history, we've rarely looked back since. The original sin in the Garden of Eden didn't look like Eve consciously deciding she was going to be bad and sin rather than obeying the instruction of God. The original sin looked like Eve curiously choosing for herself despite God's instructions. In our lives, our sin doesn't usually look like an intentional decision to be bad. It almost always looks like a subconscious choice to choose for ourselves what is best for us and what we desire and what we think we want and need. We are creatures made to worship. But because we are fallen, Because we rebelled, we quickly choose to worship ourselves. And that is where our sexual sin begins. Not in choosing to be bad, but in choosing to be our own, despite recognizing we were created as His. Regardless of social class, race, or culture, sex uniformly seems to become one of the first things we choose for ourselves. Though sex was created as an act of worship toward God, we waste no time in making it its own God and worshiping at the throne of our wants. From pornography to masturbation to promiscuity to lust, we've chosen to choose for ourselves. And if we're being honest, without being armored up with the wisdom or experience to recognize the repercussions of these are all things we want. Don't get me wrong. Our society will work its hardest to convince us there's nothing wrong with this. We have a living, breathing Word of God spelling out exactly what is best for us, exactly what will guard our hearts, what we can place our faith in and rely on, what will lead us in the way we should go. But we have a culture coaxing us to close that book, to muffle that truth, and to instead worship our own bodies and minds whenever, however, and with whomever we choose. We have the Word telling us, be careful. The human heart is the most deceitful of all things and desperately wicked. Who really knows how bad it is? Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9. While we have the world telling us, no, the heart wants what it wants. Follow your heart, trust your feelings, put all your stock in your own emotions. We have the Word telling us the temptations in your life are no different from what others experience, and God is faithful. He will not allow the temptation to be more than you can stand. When you are tempted, He will show you a way out so you can endure. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. While we have the world telling us, the temptation and the tease are a part of the pleasure. You can't help what you're attracted to, and you can't help giving in to your physical desires. It's sexual attraction. Clearly your body wants it, so why not have it? It's your life. We have the Word telling us what will lead us in the way we should go. God's will is for you to be holy, so stay away from all sexual sin. Then each of you will control his own body and live in holiness and honor, not in lustful passion like the pagans who do not know God and his ways. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 3 through 5. While we have the world telling us, sexual immorality is subjective to opinion. You're going to abstain? You're going to wait until you're married and never try anything sexually first? Good luck in keeping a boyfriend or a girlfriend if you're not going to be physical with them along the way. For every unchanging word of truth, we have an opinion of the world. For every call to obey and worship God first, we have a temptation to not forget about ourselves. For every secure and loving command from God, we have an insecure world, frantic and failing, proclaiming, no, choose for yourselves. You are your own. You are in control. So we sit in our sin and we desperately worship the wreckage, trying to force it to feel like enough. God's own people, who somewhere along the line chose instead to become our own people, the world's people. And just like that, the sexual desires placed within us become the sexual fixations of our rebellious hearts because we chose to choose for ourselves. Our design and our rebellion, they're two of the strongest roots at the core of our why. When we open our hearts and minds to understand the unwavering value God knit into us as women and as men, and the sin nature that consumes us in our fallen, broken state, we can start to see the source of our tensions and frustrations. When we miss the design, we can rationalize the rebellion. When we miss the wonder of our worth, we sell short the weight of our wandering. Our why must begin with our equal understanding of these two colliding forces in our lives. And when the time comes for us to either armor up and fight for our purity or give way to the rushing temptation-filled tide, we must decide whom we will serve, time after time after time. So what are we worshiping? Sex is a beautiful and powerful gift in the proper context of its intent. But I wonder today how many of us have never known it was meant to be that way. I wonder how many of us have chosen to choose for ourselves and have recklessly given pieces of ourselves away. I know that was my story. Never with the intent to be bad, never with the intent to rebel, but simply with the intent to keep up with the world and what it coaxed out of me, with the intent to explore my body and allow it to be explored by others in hopes of someone praising my beauty, with the intent to pacify the urges of pleasure and lust and desire inside of me. Not overtly at first, not to any great extreme, but my lack of understanding about my inherent worth and my insatiable curiosity called me to choose for myself, and that welcomed me down a path of sin-filled sexual wandering. They traded the truth about God for a lie, so they worshipped and served the things God created instead of the Creator himself, who is worthy of eternal praise. Romans chapter 1, verse 25. Chapter 3, Virginity, Purity, and the Gray Area in Between. I can clearly remember the day. I was sitting on the edge of a red love seat in my parents' bedroom. It's where my mom and I had most of our best talks, where the sun beamed in and scorched the color off the fabric on the back of that little two-person couch. I grew up in a conservative, well-monitored Christian home with two loving parents and a sharp older sister. We were the classic middle-class nuclear family with access to great education and a comfortable church. Our house tucked itself right inside a semicircle of neighbors' homes. There were kids and teens who lived all around us, some a great influence and some not so much. At that point in my life, I'd already been exposed to pornography, and sex was very much already on my mind. In the late 90s, there were fuzzy channels you could find on TV where porn was just distinguishable if you squinted your eyes and tilted your head far enough. I had stumbled across friends' parents' playboys at their homes and already had an older neighbor tell me everything she knew about sex and foreplay and masturbation and boys. On top of it all, I'd also started to figure out that certain things felt good on my body. I was only 9 years old. I don't think my sweet mom knew all that I had been exposed to, but she wasn't naive either. She was the world's best mom for honest conversations and over-explanations and subtle interrogations to keep tabs on me. She was also always very open about sex. She wasn't hesitant to talk to me about things other parents shied away from or danced around with their young preteens. But that day when my questions shifted from logistics on how snakes could possibly have sex, I was working on a science presentation that just wasn't adding up, and to be honest, I'm still confused on that one. And instead started to creep toward one too many overly illicit topics. I remember her sitting me down and looking at me with an endearing anxiousness. I'm sure if I had a 9-year-old tossing around terms like I probably used, I would be a bit panicked too. But she found the simplest words she could at the time and explained to me that sex was meant to be shared between a husband and a wife. That God desired for us to be virgins when we marry, meaning that we have not had sex with anyone else. She shared with me that both she and my dad were virgins when they married and had only had sex with each other, and that when you have sex, you can become pregnant. And that is how my sister and I were born and how families are formed. For a girl who idolized her parents and yearned to make them proud, I had heard all I needed to hear. I don't think a moment passed before I stood up from the couch and boldly stated, "Then, Mommy, I promise to be a virgin until I'm married, too." And with a quick twist and a tightened upper lip, my 9-year-old mind made up, I triumphantly marched out of the room. I didn't give her time to explain much else, and I suppose to a mom trying to keep things simple for a little girl, that day was a small victory. But at the time, my youth, my haste, and my mom's unintentionally oversimplified explanation became the first few ingredients in a muddied mixture of incomplete understanding about sex as a whole. The vain virginity vow. The biggest issue was that my search for deeper sexual understanding ended abruptly with my vow of virginity. My mind shelved the need for any more information about sex when I began to believe that I knew all I needed to know. My decision was made, and at such a young age, there was nothing tempting me to break that vow. There was also a sense of pride that came with the title of virgin. I wore it like a badge of honor. It was something I could control, a distinctive factor that set me apart, and a title I gradually owned and even flaunted as if it somehow amplified my righteousness for people to praise. The church exalted it as well. So to me, being in line with my parents' wishes and in line with the church's instruction made me feel like that much better of a person, like that much better of a Christian. I rolled my eyes in my own smugness at a culture and media that portrayed virginity as such a taboo thing. I never got why girls were trying to lose their virginities by prom or handing over their bodies to their first boyfriend to prove to him they loved him enough. I wasn't ever on board with the hype behind guys racking up their number and the double standard of girls being labeled if they gave themselves away just as freely. Honestly, it just all seemed messy. And if I'm being transparent here, it all felt beneath me. So I proudly waved my flag of abstinence and arrogantly exalted my intact virginity. I didn't realize this at the time, but my obedience to God's design and instruction in my sexual decisions wasn't carried out as an act of reverence and humility. It was carried out as a demonstration of my self-righteous abilities. And that sustained me for a while, but my vow of virginity started to become my own self-constructed stumbling block when suddenly the sexual temptation I had pridefully scoffed at others for wrestling with began to tempt me. It started innocently enough. I was alone. I was human and felt normal, natural urges. And it was my body. As far as I knew, masturbation had no effect on my virginity, so I could still wade into the water there and not be violating my vow. Soon enough, that sexual exploration evolved into nervous first kisses and make-out sessions if the newest boy I was interested in at the time and I could sneak away and find a private place. No effect on my virginity. Then one day their hands found the courage to wander and new feelings overcame me, and even though there were nerves within me that knew I was doing more than I should, I rationalized that it still had no impact on my virginity. And then the hands got more aggressive, and more was expected of me, and I never once felt like I knew what I was doing, but why would I give less of myself since I had already been this far with other boys? I felt like performance was expected of me, and after all, I was still a virgin. I had my virginity. Eventually, when oral sex came into the equation, I was already in the throes of promiscuity and stopped keeping track of my comfort level or my apprehensions or my dignity. I wrestled with tension and conviction, knowing it was all too much and too far, but my convicted pride rationalized that I still technically had my virginity, right? I pushed the envelope time and time again. In recent years, I've had so many Christian girls ask me if anal sex still qualifies them as a virgin. I'm never shocked or taken aback by that question. To be honest, it was one my own mind toyed with often in that time, too. I eventually got to the point of bargaining, how far is too far? How far can I go to still qualify as a virgin? What even counts as real sex? My efforts to rationalize were almost impressive looking back, soul-stealing and life-compromising, but dogged. Isn't it amazing how adaptable our hearts are to harboring sin? Our sin nature is like a chameleon disguising itself to look however it needs to look in order to make us feel like our sin isn't too much, too far, too messy. As if sin has a grading scale we can negotiate. We always could be worse, couldn't we? How far is too far was my constant question. And for my answer, I didn't look to the word, I looked to the world, because the world's response fed my raw wants first. So I spent years giving pieces of myself away sexually, all while flying my virgin banner high and half-heartedly rationalizing that I still held my virginity. And I would lie down in my own emotional filth in a college bed filled with lust and regret, and I would wonder why they would whisper and laugh to themselves when I told them I couldn't go all the way because I was a virgin. Yet like a fool, I would roll over and give pieces of myself away to make sure my newest friend knew I could still meet all of his other needs. And to help stomach the lump of conviction I felt in my throat, I would tell myself that it was my body, my right, and my freedom to choose what I wanted to do. I told myself I was powerful, I was in control, and I was even well-disciplined for not giving him everything. Looking back, I was living out the flawed logic Paul warns us against in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 12, and I didn't even realize it. You say, I am allowed to do anything, but not everything is good for you. And even though I am allowed to do anything, I must not become a slave to anything. I was trying to preserve my virginity while still doing what I wanted to do. I was trying to have my cake and eat it too. Before I even knew what had hit me, I was empty and broken and owned by temptation and lust. Sure, I had the freedom and right to do everything I was choosing to do, but it wasn't all beneficial for me. I ended up a slave in chains, trying to convince myself I was free. But my sexual appetite could no longer be satisfied by anything less than as far as I'd already gone by that point. And I despised myself for it at times, but I stood up each new morning with a righteous chip on my shoulder because I may have had a list and a past and plenty to be ashamed of, but on my wedding day I could still say I was a virgin. Surely that was enough, right? The idea of virginity, it messed with me. And why should we ever expect that it won't? Because solely holding on to the thing that is virginity can become a vow made in vain, a works-based answer to a life surrender question. God doesn't want your self-reliant promise of virginity. He wants your whole heart, with abstinence being a willing byproduct of your love for His instruction and your faithfulness to abide. But in our self-serving sin, we respond, how about instead of my whole heart, I just give you some semi-good behavior? Then we desperately cling to the hope that no matter how muddy our hearts, that credential looks clean on the surface and counts for something. You know we're only fooling ourselves, right? The narrow focus of virginity is just the surface layer under which God is inviting us to immeasurable depths of wisdom, freedom, and love. A one-dimensional focus on virginity robs us of the depth of our own soul's yearning for intimacy and its deep desire for abiding worship and worth. No, God doesn't solely call us to virginity. He calls us in all ways to purity and the power of its incredible purpose in our lives. The purpose of purity. Purity. There's another layer of the why we've missed along the way, and one I genuinely can't remember anyone talking to me about in a relatable way. Purity. The deeper, wider, broader heart condition that God actually cares about. Purity that stretches beyond our sexual choices and encompasses every facet of our lives. Purity that naturally compels abstinence as a beautiful byproduct, but is wider reaching than just our physical sexual activity. For years of my life and woven all through my story, I proudly proclaimed the shallow vow of virginity, but completely missed the greater God-honoring concept of purity. I made my prepubescent promise and even wore a ring. I was praised by other Christians for my proud and loud virginity, but all the while I was ultimately missing the point. I was flaunting the title and half-heartedly living out the call to action based on my own willpower and strength, without actually knowing why I was denying myself and why it mattered that I turn away from certain things. And because of that, every time temptation came, my willpower grew weaker and my wants grew stronger, until eventually my tank full of self-motivation ran on empty and temptation, lust, and pressure owned me. My sexual decision-making was built on the man-made sands of righteousness and rule-following rather than being rooted in the God-designed rock foundation of a pure heart seeking to honor a king who loved me. But how could it have been? I had missed the why. I had been preached to about virginity, coached in the do's and don'ts, but a conversation about the bigger picture of purity compelling those choices, that was one the church forgot. And admittedly, one I hadn't sought. I think my parents assumed the church was pointing me toward the bigger concept of purity, and the church assumed my parents were covering that ground. But the fact of the matter is that it wasn't a conversation I broached with my family because I didn't know it was one I should have. And the church stayed so tight-lipped, so nervous as to what age they were supposed to begin to navigate such a taboo concept that once they did start talking about sex and abstinence, it was simply through the fearful approach of, you have to wait. Which wasn't all wrong. But harping on avoidance, seemingly for its own sake, did little to prepare me for when rule-following seemed mundane and what I was doing still felt permissible when I asked myself, do I still count as a virgin if I don't go all the way? When we exalt virginity as the goal and disassociate how purity plays any role, it's way too easy to lose ourselves in that gray area in between. I had missed the three most beautiful layers of purity. I had missed, 1, the purity in God's design and design of me, 2, the purity in His redemption of me through Jesus,